You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
We have a fascinating story to talk about today about an individual who grew up in, grew up in Louisiana and became such an important figure. And when you read some of the book jacket comments, people say, you know, we should know more about this guy. This guy is really important. A lot of people know his name from a commercial sense, but they really don't know the story behind him. And I think it's a fascinating story. And with me is the author of a book called The Sugar King. Leon Gottschalk, a New Orleans legend, the Creole slave, and his Jewish roots. And there's just so many different angles to this, and they're all fascinating. So so with me is Peter Wolf. He's a native of New Orleans. Spent a lot of time on the East Coast, too. Got all kind of really impressive books that he's written. And if he's done nothing else in life, he could be impressed by the fact that the foreword was written by Calvin Trillin, who's one of my favorite people. And he has a very impressive foreword, but I noticed that that in the last couple of paragraphs of his tribute, he talks pretty much about that, about Gottschalk and all the different angles to him and how important he was in so many different ways. And he says, Peter Wolf did not inherit any of Leon Gottschalk's sugar land. We should mention you're a third generation of...
Fifth generation here in New Orleans.
But he's a great-great-grandson who happened to be steeped in the lore of the family in the family's home territory. He was left a valuable request by the Sugar King, life story that begged to be told. And so thank you for telling the story. So let's begin with Leon Gottschalk. In the immigrant days, when he came over as a child, and he came over from France, what were those circumstances?
Well, he was a little boy in a family that was overwhelmed. His mother had become a widow. His father was the village butcher in a town in a small village in Lorraine called Ebervilliers. And the family was destitute, basically. He was forced to leave school and start peddling around in villages near where he lived when he was about 10 years old. So he was never educated. He was illiterate, couldn't read or write. And he just decided as a courageous young child at about 13 that there was no future here for him in this village in Lorraine. So all by himself, he gets in a carriage, goes to Paris. From Paris, he transfers to another carriage, goes to Le Havre, catches a steamer, is below decks for 4 months, and ends up in New Orleans.
Now, where what year would this have been?
It's 1837 when he lands. He gets on that boat in 1836. His birthday, between 12 and 13, is at sea in the Atlantic. And he lands in 1837 when New Orleans is this second biggest city in the country, third biggest port. And he's in the middle of a very dynamic place with no assets and no skills.
Now, how did the poor kid arrange getting in a boat and getting to New Orleans?
Well, the family saved a little money, which got him the tickets all the way. It was very inexpensive because in those days, down in the part of France he was in, there were steamer brokers who were selling extremely cheap tickets to America for people who wanted to get out of France. And his family was able to afford getting him to Paris and getting him on that boat. He had nothing when he got here except the clothes on his back. He had one letter to a guy who owned a warehouse in the warehouse, what we now call the warehouse district, and Mr. Jonas. And that man put him up for a couple of weeks in the back of the warehouse and fed him, taught him a few phrases. and said, "Listen, you little guy." And he was very small. He was about 5'5", dazzling blue eyes. He said, "You've got to get out of New Orleans. Get out of here. I'm sending you up the river with a pack on your back." The reason he wanted to get him out of New Orleans wasn't because he was an obnoxious kid, but because yellow fever was raging in New Orleans in 1837 when he landed. So this little boy spends 2 or 3 years pedaling up and down the Mississippi River, up what we call River Road, and makes a go of it. He comes back every week, gives Mr. Jonas his money that he helped stock the backpack, sends a little money to his mother, and goes out again. He finally develops enough capital to get a cart and a horse, so that magnifies his carrying capacity and lets him do a little better. And ultimately, he starts a very small store in Convent, Louisiana, before he becomes a merchant in New Orleans.
So all this
took about 4 or 5 years.
So all this was from money he raised just by going up the river, just peddling goods?
Notions, yeah.
Yeah, and Mr. Jonas, is that his name, had kept supplies, and so he sold his supplies?
No, I think he just found supplies that this child could carry on his back, and ribbons and needles and things that people might want at plantations that an itinerant peddler could offer them, scraps of things. And eventually he began to take orders for things when he had a carriage or a cart, really. And he then learned how to take orders and began to actually supply and have clients and customers and so forth. So he built up, he saved, and he built up, and then he finally could rent a little store in Convent.
So he, in those days, I guess a lot of the commerce was done by peddling. They're probably going up and down the road, just different people selling different things, but he made more of a success out of it.
He did. He was obviously smart and also engaging. There's absolute evidence that he was extremely bright, even though he was illiterate. And for instance, when he comes into New Orleans finally to open a store, there are about 240 competing stores, and he's successful. He opens a store first right along the riverfront in what was then called Old Levy Street. We now call it Decatur Street. And he thrives in the midst of a gigantically competitive commercial market in clothing, and in boys and men's clothing only. That was his specialty when he finally opens a store.
Okay. Now, when he first arrived, did he have any command of English at all?
No, he knew no English. He knew no English, and he couldn't read, and he couldn't write. And by the way, throughout his entire life, when he becomes, as you know, an extremely distinguished, important, well-off merchant, sort of a prince of New Orleans, he still can't read or write. I searched out his signatures everywhere. They're loppy, children-like efforts to make a signature, and he couldn't read or write. I don't know why he couldn't. I think he was probably severely dyslexic because he treasured education. He sent all his kids to very good schools. And his wife was educated, married a young girl from Lorraine, a French immigrant also. She was educated. I think that helped him a lot. And he hired very educated people for his stores, and that helped him a lot. But he never penetrated the reading and writing.
But with the people who he hung around with and that he needed to be able to develop, I guess it speaks well of his personality. I mean, you'd think that no one was really condescending to him. I mean, I guess he earned some respect from the beginning.
Absolutely. The loyalty was absolute. The people that he hired in the earliest days in New Orleans, 3 or 4 clerks, bookkeepers, and so forth, stayed with him the rest of his life. He had no labor troubles ever, even though at his height, with his 14 plantations and his multiple stores, he employed over 3,000 people. He never had any labor troubles. He was a revered and respected guy. And I've heard this from ancestors of people who worked for him and who worked for the Gotcho Enterprises, how much he was thought of, how well he was thought of.
Now, while he was peddling, you tell the story about it's the home of a woman who meets that has a son, and he befriends them. Could you tell about that?
Yeah, sure. When he was in his peddling days, he would go to plantations and, of course, offer his goods. And after he had offered his goods to the owners of the plantations, he would ask if he could go into the quarters and also sell things to the slaves. And I believe he met a family while he was doing that. And the young child in the family was somebody he grew to like. So very light-skinned boy who was the son of a woman named Therese, a slave woman named Therese. The son, it turned out, was the child of the plantation owner, the white plantation owner. This child was called Tassin. It was really called Joachim only. He had only a first name originally. The rumor was when Leon got to New Orleans that he actually got off the boat with this child and that they were friends for the rest of their lives and worked together. The facts that I found out, and it was very hard work to find out some of these contracts and some of these activities that took place up in the countryside. What really happened is Leon, in about 1849, went up the river and bought Joachim Tassin, this boy he had admired as a child. And Tassin came to New Orleans and worked for Leon and with Leon for the rest of his life.
Okay.
Now, the important thing about, one of the important things about this story, which I catalog very carefully in this book, because it has to do with all the problems of slavery and free people of color navigating life in the South through slavery, through the Civil War, through Reconstruction, and through Jim Crow. Gotcho and Tassin agree the day he's purchased that they will forever keep it a secret that Tassin was a slave child. And so when he gets to New Orleans with Mr. Gotcho, he's thought of as a free person of color. And that allows him to penetrate all kinds of opportunities in New Orleans that he wouldn't have had as a slave. Gotcho protects him that way, and Tassin, to his grave, he lives longer than Gotcho, never tells anybody he was a slave, and Gotcho never tells anybody that Tassin was a slave.
And what was the process to get him recognized legally? I mean, essentially, is he adopting him?
No, it was very complicated because the people that own slaves, even if they wanted to emancipate them, were under certain terribly difficult regulations. One was, it depends on the year you're talking about, so I'm going to be in general. You had to kind of guarantee that any slave you emancipated wouldn't become a problem to the public will, that the public coffers were not going to have to support this emancipated slave. So you had to, in some years, you had to post bonds and guarantee employment. In other years, in Louisiana, you even had to buy a ticket to send the emancipated slave back to Africa. So Tassin and Gotcho had to work out very carefully what to do to emancipate this worker, co-worker, so that he wouldn't be forced back to Africa. And while they were in the process of doing that, the Civil War broke. And of course, it then became mute. He was automatically freed once the Civil War was over. But it was never disclosed, ever. In both of their obituaries, Tassin is described as a lifelong worker and friend of Gotcho's. Tassin served as a pallbearer for Leon Gotcho, and nobody ever knew he was a slave or had been a slave.
And Tassin's mother was obviously fully supportive of all this.
Well, she was supportive, but I'm sure she was heartbroken in a way because he was purchased at a dissolution sale of the plantation. And I couldn't find out what happened to the mother, to Therese. The father was obviously dead because he was the owner of the plantation. That's why the plantation was being liquidated. But I wanted very much to find out what happened to his mother, and I couldn't.
All right.
She may have stayed in touch with him in New Orleans for all I know. There's just no record of it.
So once he was established in New Orleans, was he pretty much treated as a son or in terms of providing?
No, it wasn't treated as a son. He was treated as a revered worker, as a very highly respected worker. He was an excellent tailor. He was a very good salesman, apparently. He worked at the stores with Leon Gottschall. Eventually, he got to the point where he was making business decisions for the company. But he was never disguised as a son. And he wasn't a son. I checked the possibilities of his being a son very carefully, but the chronology doesn't work.
So he became really a business partner. By this time, Leon had opened. Had he opened the equivalent of a department store yet?
Yeah, he opens his, well, what we call a department store. He didn't open for quite a while, but he had a specialty retail store for men's and boys' clothing on Decatur Street and then on Canal Street during the Civil War. He doesn't really open what we call a department store until after the Civil War. And it thrives. He also, besides just being a retail store, he learns about the sewing machine when he has an episode in his life where he takes his family to New York just before the Civil War. He's afraid the country's going to break apart and the South's going to be destroyed and New Orleans is going to be decimated. So he spends a couple of years in New York and gets back to New Orleans during the Civil War. But while he's in New York, he finds out about the sewing machine. None existed in New Orleans at the time. And so when he comes back, he brings a sewing machine with him, and he becomes consequently the very first person to manufacture clothing in New Orleans. They'd been so he was a retailer and a manufacturer and a wholesaler because he began to stock goods for wholesale distribution during the Civil War to send out to the countryside.
So this is a whole new direction. Like any clothes that people would have had, otherwise, other than what they made at home, would have been shipped to New Orleans and some kind of. And so here you have somebody in New Orleans actually making new clothes.
He did, and he learned to manufacture clothing by being in New York, where he saw what was going on in the garment district.
Now, meanwhile, Tassin gets more and more involved in the business at a managerial level.
Tassin, exactly. He's. If Leon's away or out of town or in some way not available, everybody in the store began to consult Tassin about business decisions. He was totally trusted. But then things happen. After the Civil War, when Tassin's, of course, free, and we're in the Reconstruction period, when things are better for Blacks, he decides, he gets Leon's permission to go to Europe for a month, he and his wife. He marries twice, Tassin does. First, a Black lady who's a free person of color, and his second marriage is to a white French woman from Bordeaux. Anyway, he goes to Europe, and in Europe, Tassin sees how well-treated, comparatively well-treated, Black people are and Black commercial people are and entrepreneurs. So he comes back and he asks Leon for kind of a leave, and he wants to quit and open his own business. Leon says, fine, good luck. And Tassin opens his own store. So he's not always an employee of Gottschall's. Unfortunately, that store, which is located almost exactly where Leon's original stores were on Old Levy Street, is burned down. Or the interior is burned. I think it's probably arson. During the beginning of the Jim Crow period. So he's an independent merchant for about 8 years. Then he comes back to Leon and says, this horrible thing happened. Will you take me back? And Leon says, of course, he's back at work as soon as he wants to be with his old job and his old status. So he works for Gottschall all of his life, except for that interval, that 8 year interval.
Was there any ill feeling during that time when he went and established his own business?
Well, I couldn't prove it. I couldn't find that there was, but I believe there must have been. Because, for instance, Tassin's advertising campaign mirrors exactly the language and the merchandise of Lyons. The store that Tassin opens is just where Lyons' first stores were on Old Lebby Street. And I have to believe that there was a little bit of not just competition, but perhaps a little bit of disappointment on Lyons' part that this man he had done so much for and protected was competing with him so directly instead of selling something else, other kinds of merchandise. But he takes him back right away. It's not a animosity that's harbored ever.
Yeah. But how old was Tassin by the time he opens that store?
He's in his 40s.
Yeah.
I don't have the dates exactly right on my fingertips, but he's in his 40s.
Okay. And so he'd have had time to just learn a whole lot of stuff about the business and was really ready to move into
Oh,
it.
yes, he was thoroughly schooled in the business by then.
Yeah. If not for the fire, do we know if his store was doing okay?
Everything I could find out is that he was not in any difficulty, that he was doing okay,
And
that
was
he
he
was.
manufacturing his clothes too?
No, he wasn't. He was just selling again the same things, boys and men's clothing, but he wasn't manufacturing.
All right. Okay, so back to Leon. At some point, he gets the hankering to develop a really big store, a building, which would become the department store. What prompted that?
Well, he just kept expanding. Leon was an energetic, optimistic, and very frugal businessman. And when his trade was good enough, he expanded into larger stores on Canal Street. And towards the end of his life, he had been trying for 30 years to assemble the property at the corner of Charters and Canal. He was finally able to at the end of his life and designed with an engineer and an architect and built a huge emporium, very fine general store, which we no longer can see because it was torn down for the Marriott Hotel, which is on that site now. And there he had a wider variety of goods, but still principally boys and men's. It wasn't until the next generation came and they opened the store on Canal Street that anyone who remembers God Chose Now went to in the 800 block, that it became a general department store. It was a very fine department store. I think it was considered the premier store in its day, the early 20th century.
And that 800 and 900 blocks of Canal Street were getting to be where those kind of stores were developing. I mean, there was competition there. I mean, we'd see Maison Blanche and D.H. Holmes on
And
those
D.H.
blocks.
Holmes were both there. That's right. That's why they moved down there, is because it became the premier retail area in the city. And they were up in nearer the river originally, and that was sort of diminished as a retailing, good quality retailing area. Became saloons and smaller businesses and that kind of thing.
And then at some point, I'm not sure the year, but you'd have Rubenstein's across the street, all in that area, all in that cluster.
Yeah, Rubens, and of course, Rubenstein's is the only one of those stores still there.
And these are all, I think, these are all the Jewish entrepreneurs that are starting these stores.
Yes. I'm not sure about D.H. Holmes, but there were a lot of Jewish entrepreneurs in New Orleans at the turn of the century, in clothing stores and in general goods stores. Most of them weren't on Canal Street. They were on Dryades Street and Rampart Street. But there were a lot of Jewish entrepreneurs selling goods in New Orleans in the early 20th century.
Right. Then how did he become fascinated? What was the link to the cane fields and to the sugar industry?
Well, after the war, the war, of course, means the Civil War when we're
For
talking
sure.
about
Yeah.
this subject. After the war, the agricultural economy of this region was completely demolished. There had been no new equipment, no planting materials, and of course, there was no longer any labor. all the labor was gone. The folks who, black folks who had been the slaves working those fields, were emancipated. Most of them moved to the city. So Leon was approached by a woman that he knew very well from his peddling days and his merchant days, and asked for, and she asked him for help in financing, maintaining the financing in her failing plantation. Her name was Sophie Botescue. And Leon refused during the Civil War when there was still slavery going on. But she came to him after the war with in even more dire trouble. And he lent her a fair amount of money, enough to keep her going a year or two. And she came back to him in the store and said, "Mr. Gottschall, I just can't make a go of it. I wish you would buy me out." And he was fond of her. And also, of course, he realized the industry was totally decimated. And probably he thought maybe there's an opportunity here. So he gave her a deal she couldn't refuse. He bought the place. He offered her a life tenancy at her house on the plantation at no cost, and paid her a huge and handsome sum in addition. Well, she soon moved back to New Orleans, left the place entirely. Her sons were living in New Orleans, and he took over this completely derelict plantation at reserve, and he got interested in it. He got involved in it. He learned how to upgrade the machinery. He hired chemists and scientists, and he completely changed the way sugar refineries done, using that plantation as his kind of keystone. He eventually bought 14 different plantations, organized them into three clusters, consolidated the refinery process, put small railroads in the fields to bring the cane in, eliminated a lot of the intense hard labor, and became what was ultimately known as the Sugar King of Louisiana through his ingenious use of equipment, materials, science, and very good labor practices.
And there were 14, I guess, former plantations that were available that he was able to acquire?
Well, there were a lot more than that. There were, at the time, we can't even imagine how decimated this primary industry was. I think before the Civil War, there was something like 2,000 plantations in the general marketing region of New Orleans. And after the Civil War, there was something like 200. They had gone completely bankrupt. People couldn't maintain them. There was, as I said, no labor. And it was really a... Remember, a lot of these places were financed with Confederate currency. And a lot of the wealth of the plantation owners before the Civil War was held in slaves. And after the Civil War, the currency was worth zero. And the slave labor was worth zero. So owners were literally wiped out. Leon had done several very smart things. One is he didn't own any land. He didn't own any real estate before the Civil War. The other thing he did, and he owned no slaves before the Civil War. Well, he owned a house slave or two from time to time to help with his 10 children. But when the war was coming on, he was very fearful. He had a kind of European point of view, having grown up in France. He took all the assets he could marshal, and he went to New York, and he converted them to gold and silver. And this meant that whether the Confederate currency went to nothing or the Union currency went to nothing, he had something that was negotiable in the world, gold and silver. So after the Civil War, he was a relatively well-off man compared to most people who had any means at all in this region. And that allowed him to accumulate these plantations. His courage allowed him to get into a business that looked like a disaster.
You know, your story about after the Civil War and there's no laborers anymore, like no former slave laborers. And it also reminds me about the story of the Italians. The Italians were recruited to come into into Louisiana to work in different fields, and in that case, a lot of Sicilians, and the weather was the same as in Sicily. And for that, that was really the beginning of the Sicilian migration into Louisiana also.
Yeah. Plus, blacks and whites were willing to work in the fields for a salary, which they hadn't been any before. So the absence of labor did create this vacuum, as you said, and various people came into the region. Of course, Germans had been in the region before that. It occupied the German coast along the river, but there weren't enough people in of that group of farmers to make very much of a difference.
But you,
in the 1870s.
Yeah. You'd mentioned that in his labyrinth of plantations that he had a railroad. How did that happen?
Well, the commercial railroads came down the river after the war, and he saw what that kind of transportation could do. And he had the idea, well, why not order miniatures or replicas that are two-thirds the size of a commercial railroad and lay some tracks in the field and see if we can use the engines and the carts and the cars to haul cane to the refineries. So he actually ordered from the Baldwin company, which were the manufacturers of locomotives, three-quarter and half-size replicas of the commercial railroads, and he laid the tracks in the field, and he created an entire railroad line that connected his plantations. First, it was three separate groups because he had three refineries, and then he could ultimately combine them. And these were miniature, but they did the job. And school kids loved to ride on them, and they were a sensation when they were first introduced in the fields.
Did he grow cane as well, or did he just process?
Oh, yeah. No. He grew cane on all of those plantations. He processed it on... What he did is he consolidated. Every plantation before the war had its own processing refinery systems, you know, its kettles that were burned and cane syrup made and so forth. He eliminated all that overlap and waste, and he made three large modern refineries and had the fields from the 14 plantations feed into those three refineries, so that he really changed the landscape of how property was used to make the sugar more effective and cheaper and more economical.
And didn't he become...
He did the same thing with the internal refining. He invented, he used something called a multiple effect evaporator that somebody else had invented and never really commercialized. He used that to allow the processing of sugar to be made much more inexpensively, less dangerously, and at lower heats. He was brilliant about adapting science. Not an inventor, but an adapter.
But didn't he become the model for the sugar industry at large? I mean, more another
yes.
Going to him.
Yeah, I think so. He became routinely known as the sugar king, and it was meant in a positive way, not that he was lording over as a king might, but that he was superior in his management and his organization, his labor practices, and so forth. He was famous for when he bought cane externally, not up from his own fields, paying the highest prices to small producers. And his refineries were so effective that ultimately cane was being shipped from the Caribbean to his refineries along the river because they were so good. And yes, I think he was considered the preeminent sugar producer and refiner in the region. Gaucho Sugars, which it's called, distributed before his period was over, to 22 states in the South Central regions. It was a really big deal.
Would it be fair to Or at all accurate to compare him to like a Henry Ford type person to develop a new technology for an industry or a system?
I think there are ways to do that that are accurate. And there are ways that distinguishes him from Ford and Vanderbilt and such that I think are very important. He was keen to make things better, safer and so forth, as Ford might have. But what he didn't do is use other people's money. He didn't create syndicates. He didn't create stock options. He didn't merge and collaborate, all of that. He used his own money, carefully assembled, very wisely deployed, whereas most of the big industrialists in the country operated through the exchanges and through stocks and through all kinds of other financial manipulation. He never did that. Unfortunately, his grandchildren tried to do that. Now we're skipping two generations down to his grandchildren, and it created terrible problems, really disasters.
Okay. We should mention that his wife, he was married and they had a home in New Orleans and what, the 10 kids?
Yes. 10 kids that lived. He had two more that didn't at childbirth. One died in New Orleans and one died in New York. But he had 10 very successful kids who all lived in New Orleans, 7 boys and 3 girls. And it took all 7 boys in their generation to run the enterprises that he managed himself. I mean, imagine running 14 plantations and 3 huge refineries and the most effective retail business and wholesale business in clothing all by yourself with good help, but he was the guy.
Now, at his prime, where was his main concentration, the sugar or the retail, the clothing?
It went from retail to sugar. Once he started up with Reserve in the 1867, 8, 9, he began to spend more of his time in the sugar, on the sugar side of things. He really had to create a business out of the sugar, the destitute situation that the sugar industry was in. And he had the retail and wholesale and manufacturing businesses running really well with great help and with Tassin on board. And he didn't have any comparable senior executives helping him in the sugar business. So he had to spend most of his time in the later years on the sugar business. But he never lived on any of the plantations. They were really places of industry for him. He always lived in New Orleans.
And tell us about his wife.
Well, she's a great figure. She came to New Orleans with her parents, unlike Leon. She wasn't an orphan. Her parents were school teachers in Lorraine. They were educated people, and they saw to her education. When she came here, what she did was worked as a young seamstress in a store on St. Ann Street. And she was just sewing and knitting and doing things for that store when Leon met her. She went on to move after they married, which was a year or so after they met. She moved into his apartment, which was above the store. He never bought a house until after the Civil War. He lived above his store on Old Levee Street, facing the soot and the noise of the riverfront. And she lived there with him and bore children. And together they had 10 kids. And I think she helped him every day with doing things like reading the paper, maybe reading confidential papers that he didn't want to share with his employees, and taking care of kids and being a marvelously, she was known to be quick-witted and kind of adorable. She had blue eyes that people talked about, dazzling blue eyes, and a mischievous kind of lady, but nevertheless, very competent, serious, and a helpmate all his life. After he died, she finally left Esplanade Avenue where they lived and moved uptown to St. Charles Avenue. But she didn't do that until move up to the American section until he had died.
Now, did all the kids get into the businesses?
They went into various parts of the businesses, yeah. Some went to the sugar company, some went to the retail business. One or two stayed in town to work kind of as legal and banking people for the Gotcho enterprises. But they all remained part of it. Some had other things they did as well. One became a judge part of the time. One became a banker part of the time. One became the first, I think, the vice president of the Whitney Bank when it started. But they were deeply ingrained in the fabric of New Orleans, and their territory was the Gotcho Enterprises.
Yeah, the picture in your book of President-to-be Taft, who like led a delegation, I think, of plantation owners or refinery people. And I think I said there's 100 of them, and they're standing on the gallery in front right there. But were they there just to show them, here's how it should be done?
Yeah, I mean, he was that famous that if you were going to bring a delegation of big shots to New Orleans and they wanted to see the sugar business, sugar industry, well, where would you go? You'd go to Gotcho's plantation at Reserve. And they were all there. And of course, fortunately, some pictures were taken. Those pictures were misinterpreted in the press years later. Everybody said, oh, that's President Taft. He wasn't President Taft at the time. He was the secretary, cabinet member Taft, who became president. And the family did a reenactment of that picture when we had a big reunion. It was really fun to do. We did it in costumes, and everybody took one of the spots and one of the roles. And I think I published a reenactment picture as well.
We're talking to Peter Wolf, who's the author of a great book called The Sugar King, Leon Gotcho, a New Orleans legend, his Creole slave and his Jewish roots. Well, you mentioned the Jewish roots, and you have a good passage in your book where you talk about the Jewish communities in New Orleans and where they came from in Europe and what the affiliations were in the various churches. It's a good kind of blueprint to understanding the Jewish community in the city. But you also have an interesting statement about the traditional Jewish attitude towards slavery. And I think it makes some interesting points.
Well, it's just that in the history of Judaism, Jews themselves were slaves many times. And I've learned this later. I've learned more about it later because I'm writing another book now about early days having to do with the Etruscans and the Jews. It's deep in the kind of Jewish literature that they were enslaved many times, enslaved early on in the Holy Land. They were enslaved by the Romans. They were enslaved by the Mesopotamians, by the Assyrians. It's part of the Jewish tradition to have been slaves. So it makes a kind of alliance, I think, even today, with enslaved people and underprivileged people. It's part of the kind of Jewish ethos. It's not built terribly much into the liturgy, but it is in some of the ceremonies that Judaism has. And so I think that made a difference about how Jews treated and thought about slaves. Now, not every Jew, I'm not saying every Jew by any means, there are a lot of stories about Jewish owners of slaves who were brutal as anyone else and as thoughtless as anyone else. But in general, I think that long ago history permeates the feelings of a broadly based Jewish community about slavery, and did at the time. I think it did with Leon Gotcho.
How does the story end with Leon? He died what year?
He dies in 1899.
And then gradually the ownership is divided up among his family members. And there are some hard times ahead, aren't there, in terms of the ownership and the in the legal struggles?
Well, the clothing business and the sugar business are kind of distinct. The clothing business is never divided up. It continues as the Leon Gottschall Clothing Company and run by family members, run very successfully by his children, several of them. But when it's his grandchildren's time, things are pretty rough in the clothing business for independently owned family stores. But also they make some terrible mistakes, overexpand, try to become more diversified than they really were capable of, and also go into debt to do a lot of those things. And finally, that store, the Gottschall Clothing Company, has to declare bankruptcy. I think it was a question of very bad management and not very prescient. Leon was very prescient. He never would have gotten into that trouble, I think. Now, the sugar industry is a different matter. There, again, family members ran it very well in the second generation. In the third generation, there was division between those who didn't want to keep it going and those who did. And those who didn't want to keep it going made kind of an underhanded deal to sell their shares. And that became actually was a majority share to the Zeckendorf interests in New York, who wanted the real estate. They have owned, after all, 75,000 acres. And they didn't want the sugar industry business, which got spun off by Zeckendorf. And the whole thing got lost, basically, in these deals where the management was divided somewhat. So that's a very sad story. And part of it has never been told. I was able to find out what really happened and publish that in the book.
So where would the link to Gottschall Sugar be now?
Well, the sugar industry as we know it in South Louisiana is very diminished. So the lands that were once Gottschall lands are in a variety of different things. One is in the Boncarré Spillway is partly Gottschall land. A lot of the subdivisions in La Place are Gottschall land. A lot of the oil refinery activity up along the river on the East Bank is Gottschall land. About all that remains that you can see as a visitor is the superintendent's house at Reserve, which has been preserved by a historic preservation group up in Reserve and a little bit with family help. That house has been saved on its own little piece of land, and someday will be reconfigured and repurposed as a museum or as some other public use. Right now, you can see it along the River Road. It's very pretty, and it's fixed up. All the hurricanes, the damage is corrected, and it's nice to look at. And there's a little store next to it, too. But that's all that's left, and that's not owned by the Gottschalls. That's owned by a Historic Preservation Society.
And didn't a couple of the engines from the train survive and sold in different places?
Yes, the right there at Reserve, there is one of the engines on a piece of track. So that survived. And then Walt Disney, but he loved the engines. He's a train buff. He bought one of the engines from one of the railroads of Leon's, and he has it out in Disneyland, actually hauling visitors now. And it's been refurbished and cleaned up and shined up, but it's Leon's engine. And then there's some others at museums, at historic museums out in California and elsewhere, where they're museums of automotive and railroad interest.
So these are smaller gauge engines than what you see on the train track today? Or?
Yeah, they're smaller gauge. It's a different gauge rail. They won't run on commercial rail lines, but Disney, the whole railroad system in Disney World is that smaller gauge. Apparently Walt Disney spent over $1 million refurbishing that particular engine, cleaning it up and making it solid for his purposes.
And whatever happened to Tassin?
Well, Tassin lives after Gaccio dies. He continues to work at the store. He retires. The company puts him on an extremely generous pension. He travels around. He goes back to the store and talks to people once he's retired. And finally, he dies in 1910 and is buried in St. Louis Cemetery No. 2 in a very nice tomb there. And as I said, he was one of Gaccio's pallbearers in 1899 in Metairie Cemetery, where Gaccio and his wife, Justine, are buried.
Boy, really in the middle of history at St. Louis No. 2. So
we had
Warren Bell on the podcast. I don't know if you remember the former news anchor, and he has his family connections that go through there, and he's been spending a lot of time doing research. Well, look, thank you very much for this book. It's really important. It's going to open up, as it did for me, insight into some, you know, a character in the time that nobody really knew much about. The book is called, I'll say it again, The Sugar King. Although you also mentioned that you didn't think Leon would like being called the Sugar King because of the association with European royalty.
Yes, that's right. I don't think he would have liked the term. It was a term kind of foisted upon him because he was. And it came out of, I think, an article written in Los Angeles by a reporter who came to understand the sugar industry in this region and realized that Gaccio was the guy and called him the Sugar King, and I think it stuck.
But it's less bulky than the Sugar Prime Minister or the Sugar President. You know? And people in New Orleans certainly relate to the word king. You know. So anyway,
right. It's called King, true.
Leon Gaccio, a New Orleans legend, comma, his Creole slave, comma, and his Jewish roots. We had someone on from the Museum of Southern Jewish History a few weeks ago, and he mentioned that your book is on sale there, too.
It's on sale there. It's on sale in a number of places. And if people would like a autographed copy from me and maybe inscribed any way they want it, you can just email me, and I can send you a form to get it autographed and sent out to somebody. I'd love to do that.
Okay, and so what is your email?
It's peter@petermwolf.com. Don't forget the M. peter@petermwolf.com. Be happy to inscribe copies.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been delightful. Thanks for doing this. And the next book is about what?
The next book is going to be about going way back, about how the Etruscans and the Jews really spent a lot of time together, and that I think a lot of Jewish people in America and elsewhere are part Etruscan, and that's going to be a surprise because the Etruscans have kind of died out at about 100 AD as a civilization.
That's fair. And they were really the ones who really influenced the Roman civilization. That's so much that the Romans did came from, they learned from them.
That's exactly right. They really were the forerunners of the Roman civilization, taught them what they needed to know.
Okay, well, this is a future book, and let's talk about that one too. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.